Welcome to the conclusion of Dr. Jack Opperley's series on four women you should never forget. Today, we'll hear the story of Mother Teresa, the rebellious nun. And just a few words about what's coming up. Next Sunday, June 4th, we will not have a seminar. There's one worship service at 10 a.m. And then on June 11th, we start a three-week series with Derek Woodard Lehman of Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. He's a lecturer in theology and ethics, and he's going to tackle polarization and the unmaking of America. He's going to look at the causes and effects of polarization in American life and how we as Christians can be good citizens, good neighbors, and good witnesses in these troubled times. There's a lot more information on the website, but I hope you can make it and tell your friends, because I think this promises to be a really rewarding series. And now, thank you, Jack, for being with us these 4 weeks, and we look forward to the final session and your opening prayer.
Thank you, Sarah. Let us pray. God, for the beauty of the world, we give you thanks. Not only in the loveliness of a morning, the beauty of a sun, the wonder of flower, but in the goodness which your grace brings to our world. This day, teach us how to celebrate beauty in a simple and meaningful way. Through Christ our Lord. Amen. A couple of quick comments. One afternoon on a Pan Am flight across the world, the co-pilot emerged from the flight deck, took the microphone, and announced that there was a very special guest on board. After making that announcement, he took off his cap and he passed it around the passengers. And when it was finished, he had managed to collect over $600 for the special guest. A president was once asked what he said to her in a private conversation. The president responded, "I listened." And of course, there was the day when she brought a young priest to the Vatican to introduce him to the Pope. He was not an invited guest, and that trespass was comparable to taking an uninvited guest to the White House. This person managed to find her way through the maze of the Vatican and, to the consternation of the security people, walked past every checkpoint and finally took the young priest into the papal residence, where she introduced him to the pontiff. Of course, the individual was Mother Teresa. And those are just a few of the meaningful experiences in her life that teach us so much about our lives. So where was she born? She was born in what we today call Albania. She was born in the year 1910. Her father was a very successful businessman. He was a partner in a construction company. He was also a political activist. There is some sense that he also trafficked in narcotics. On a business trip, her father very mysteriously died. And it is held to this day that probably he was poisoned by someone who found his actions to be problematical. At the time of his death, the family was plunged into poverty because, you see, his partners in whatever enterprise he engaged in absconded with all of the assets. And so the mother was left with three children in abject poverty, seeking to try to feed, clothe, house, and raise them. But the most interesting thing about that mother was that in the depths of her poverty, she continued to be concerned about others. It was not uncommon to find her taking food to a neighbor who was in trouble. She invited the homeless into their home to spend the night. She cared for the sick in the little town in which they lived. And early on, Mother Teresa saw, by way of her mother's witness, what it meant to do a simple, beautiful thing in terms of caring for humanity. The home was a happy place in spite of the poverty. The happiness was encouraged by music, by prayer, and by faithful living. Agnes was sent to the convent school, and then later on to the state school, where she learned how to play the mandolin and continued her musical adventures. It is recorded by nearly every one of her biographers that she was a fun-loving child. She enjoyed walks in the countryside, reading books, and yes, going to parties. She was also a sickly child. Early on, her mother wrote that Agnes always suffered from a weak chest, which meant that she had weak lungs, was subject to all kinds of infection, and spent an awful lot of time as a child in bed. With her peers, she was popular. She was fun-loving. And above all else, for her, the meaning of faith, the wonder of the church, its liturgy, and its music were terribly formative. At the age of 12, Agnes began to wonder whether or not God was speaking to her about what she was to do with the rest of her life. Agnes was an innate leader, and therefore, as she thought about God's calling to her, she wondered how she could possibly be a leader for God, especially in light of the fact that she had a very weak chest. She went to her priest, a Father Jambrowicz, and he shared with her some wonderful stories about Jesuits who were doing some wonderful work in India and how it was that the Jesuits were leaders in the ministry of caring for the sick. And so she began to think that perhaps for her, God was making a claim upon her life that would ask her to be a leader in terms of addressing the poverty of the world. Agnes was happy at home. She liked her family life. She enjoyed the community. And she really did not wish to leave. But at the age of 18, something happened. And whatever it was convinced her that her life belonged completely, not partially, completely to God. And she began to read seriously the work of the Jesuits in India, primarily the city of Calcutta. And as a result of those influences, this young woman began to make a decision to enter the convent. And through the religious life of nuns, make a difference. Her mother was not at all excited about her daughter's calling. She feared for her well-being, her health, her very life. And so she refused to give her daughter permission and blessing to pursue a religious life. One condition: if after 24 hours of prayer, Agnes was still convinced that she should go to the convent and pursue the religious life, her mother would agree. The 24 hours were undertaken, they were completed, and they convinced her mother that her daughter was for real. And so she decided to join the Sisters of Loreto. They were a group of nuns whose mother house was in Dublin, Ireland. And so at the age of 18, she boarded a train and set off for Paris, where there was a Loreto convent, and there she interviewed as a potential candidate. She was approved, and she boarded a ship, and she began her long and arduous journey to Dublin. She arrived there in October, and for the first time in her life, Agnes actually saw a living, real nun. Think about that. She had decided to make her commitment to the religious life, having never seen or talked with a nun, save the initial interview in Paris. And upon arrival in Dublin, there they all were. She spent the next 6 weeks learning English because the Sisters of Loreto believed that English was the universal language. She also took the name of Teresa. And that is interesting. Teresa, the woman after whom she took the name, was a nun who was of the Carmelite tradition. And if you know anything about the Carmelites, you know they have an interesting approach to ministry. They spend nearly 6 months a year in meditation, prayer, and scripture study. And then for the other 6 months of the year, they can be found in prisons and in hospitals and in community centers. They're caring for the needs of people. Isn't it interesting that early on, as she chose her baptism name in the convent, she chose Mother Teresa, a Carmelite nun committed to study, to scripture, to meditation, but also to service. In December of 1928, having completed her studies in English and her orientation as a novice, she boarded a trip to be returned to India. Arriving in India, she was overcome with what she found. This is what she wrote. The people here have nothing. They live in the street. They die in the street. Most are without clothing. Few eat regular meals. Disease is rampant. Where could I possibly begin? Having completed her initial work back in India, she was sent off to Darlinga, which was a small town up near the Himalayas. And there she not only continued to develop her English, but she was also required to learn Hindu language as well as the language of Bengali. In addition to that, she learned French and Italian. And at the time of her death, Mother Teresa was fluent in nearly 9 languages. Her first job was teaching at a small Loreto school in this small community at the foothills of the Himalayas. And as she did her work teaching geography and English and all of the standard subjects, she could not forget the pictures of the people that she met. And so she began to think and ponder and meditate upon the meaning of suffering. And as she pondered the meaning of suffering, she turned to a study of Jesus. And from that study, she learned that Jesus was well acquainted with grief, in the words of the prophet. And beyond that, that Jesus had lived a life of suffering. But more than that, that the life of Jesus, filled with suffering, had become a caring, constructive, redemptive experience. And so she began to think about these children, not only in terms of geography and English, history and mathematics, but in terms of their poverty, in terms of their desperation, in terms of their inability to survive. And in one of her memoirs, she wrote this bit of history. When they bring a child to the sisters to be cared for, the parent often says these words: "If you do not take him, I will put him out for the jackal, for that is his only hope for peace." After spending several years in this little small town, she was transferred to the Loreto Convent in Calcutta, and there she continued to teach and pursue her dream of being a caring educator. She spent nearly 20 years in that convent. And across those 20 years, while it was that she sharpened her skills as a teacher and ultimately became the headmistress of that school, there was another phenomenon that was emerging. She was beginning to ponder and, in a sense, fixate on the poverty of life. And so in 1937, at the age of 27, this young woman, filled with all of these dynamics, made her final vow of chastity, poverty, and obedience. And there she took the name of Mother, which was common in the Loreto tradition. And so she became known as Mother Teresa, which was symbolic of the fact that for this woman, these children were more than students. The school operated Monday through Friday, and Mother Teresa was permitted self-time on Saturday and Sunday, and guess what she did with it? She journeyed down into the slums of Calcutta, there to wash, to clean, to clothe, to feed, and sometimes hold as they died, the children of India. In 1946, Mother Teresa made a train trip back to that first assignment that she had known at the foothills of the Himalayas. And upon returning to Calcutta on that train, she had an experience. The experience was a kind of vision. Notice what she said, a kind of vision, an awakening that called her to dedicate her life and her vocation to the poorest of the poor. She believed that this vision in which Jesus spoke with her summoned her to not only care for the poorest of the poor, but also to live with the poorest of the poor, to leave the comforts of the convent and live with those who had so little. She struggled with that vision, because she had found in the Sisters of Loreto a community, a family, a home. But after conferring with her spiritual advisor, a fellow whose name was Father Van Emke, she made the decision that perhaps she should pursue leaving the convent, beginning an order that was dedicated exclusively to caring for her passion. Father sent her to see the Archbishop. And the Archbishop first suggested that the sister needed to wait because she was so young. Secondly, he suggested to her that she needed to take seriously the vows which she had made. And he scolded her aggressively for being unfaithful. And she left that conversation, agreeing to wait a year in prayer to confirm her decision. During the year, the bishop played all kinds of games with her. He transferred her here and everywhere, trying to break her linkage to these kids and their poverty and their sadnesses. He tried to play games with her assignments, making her to feel less than important. However, obviously, the Archbishop was not a very good judge of character, for he totally misread this little woman who had been born in Albania, gone to Ireland, and was now a nun. She waited him out for a year. And finally, he had no choice but to grant her request. He had no grounds upon which to stand, excepting that in the order of the religious community, she had to make a choice. Would she leave Loreto and return to being a lay person and thus never enjoying the possibility of returning to the convent? Or would she leave the convent on a basis of just taking a kind of sabbatical to have time for consideration and prayer, et cetera, et cetera? And guess which one she chose? Obviously, the second. She knew what the bishop was playing, and she simply outplayed his game. She survived the year. And the Archbishop had no alternative but to pursue the Vatican, who in turn granted her wish to be relieved as a sister of Loreto for a trial year so that she could leave the convent and pursue her passion. One of the very first things she did was to change the habits that she had worn as a sister of Loretto to the habit that she would wear as a missionary sister of charity. The Lorettos were very, very formal, and their habits were extremely beautiful. What sister chose was a very simple white sari that she was able to purchase at a local bazaar. It was made of the cheapest cloth possible, and she liked it because it was white, suggesting the purity of intention, and it was trimmed in blue, which was a color often associated symbolically with the Virgin Mary. And so, armed in her new habit, which was less formal, less expensive, less impressive, less authoritative, Mother Teresa began her work. She found it difficult. She found living alone to be hard. She had enjoyed the community of Loretto. She had built relationships with the sisters. But perhaps there is a little bit of a lesson to be learned in how she departed the convent on their final day. She actually ordered and rode in a taxi cab, kind of suggesting that she was serious about this decision she had made. The first school was begun actually and literally in a kind of area that was filled with mud and water. It was the only place that she could find where these kids could come together. In terms of teaching them their lessons, she used a stick writing in the dirt, and the children followed. And in her memoirs, she wrote that when the children came, lessons were important. More important was their cleanliness. And so oftentimes in her language, she says that she would give them a good solid bath. And after a good solid bath, there was catechism, the teaching of the church. And after that, there were lessons about geography and history and mathematics. And after that, there were games. And there were always prizes for the games. And the prizes were consistently bars of soap that the children took with them back home. The first number of children that arrived was 9. On the second day of the school, that number had tripled to nearly 50. And so her work was launched. By the middle of 1949, having worked tirelessly in terms of addressing these children's needs, she found it difficult to live alone. And so she began to inquire, and she discovered a house in which some sisters of the poor were living. They suggested that she talk with a man whose name was Alfred Gomes. He was a local businessman from England. And she arranged to rent a room in the place where the Sisters of Charity lived so there could be some community. Obviously, Alfred Gomes was a decent man, and he said to her, "For the rent you will pay, I will furnish your apartment." She said, "That will not be necessary. All I will need is a bench, a box, and something to sleep on." The bench became her library. It's where she kept her books. The bench was also her altar at which she knelt in prayer. The box was the place where she kept what it was that she was going to give the children on the next day of school. And the bed issue was finally resolved by some of her colleagues at the convent of Loretto in Calcutta, who arrived one day with a bed that had been given to them by a person who was leaving the country and no longer needed it. And then there was this. Her spiritual advisor had given her a painting of the Sacred Heart. It's a very important piece of Catholic art and Catholic liturgy. And there with the bench and with the box and with the mattress on the floor, she hung the picture of the Sacred Heart so that she would never forget how blessed she really was. After a while, her reputation began to spread. And it's no accident. For while she appeared to be a frail, somewhat timid woman, that was anything but the truth. For example, she visited all of the local pharmacies. And her request of the pharmacist was, "Would you like to do something beautiful for God?" Think about it. How do you turn that down? And after a while, the hospitals became infuriated with her. Why? Because she was taking into that school there in that mudded area, little kids and their parents, and the hospitals would not treat. And her reputation for credibility, caring, and commitment expanded. And eventually she needed a larger building. And so she asked the authorities that ran Calcutta if they had something that they could give her to house her ministry. They gave her a building that was located next to a Hindu temple. The purpose of that building was the place where all of the pilgrims coming to the temple initially were housed. It was dirty, it was in bad repair. She had to get extra money just to get the place livable. But she did. And it was the site of the very first hospice that she began. Now, if you know anything about the Hindu tradition, they are absolutely and completely paranoid about death. They will not consider being close of any kind to a dead body. When a person dies in the Hindu tradition, they are incinerated immediately because the Hindus feel that death was somewhat contagious. Can you imagine the horror of these people arriving at this Hindu temple, seeing all of these people in the hospice who were clearly dying, and they decided they were going to do something about that? And they devised a plan, and the plan was to stone to death that evil woman. And so they arrived at the building one afternoon, armed with the stones. They crashed into the building and they sought out Mother Teresa. Mother Teresa greeted them. She talked with them. She asked to speak with their leader, a belligerent man who had stones in both hands. And when she finished her conversation with him, he turned to his colleagues and said, "Go. Do not return until you can care for these people as does this little nun." She totally won the guy over and sort of established her as a rather prominent citizen of Calcutta. Novices began to arrive, potential novices. Many of them were her former students, many of whom were Hindus who had become so impressed with Mother that they wanted to share in her work. And so they began to gather in this area close to the Hindu temple, which became their very first dwelling place alongside of those who were dying. And eventually, Mother Teresa decided it was time to organize her colleagues. And so she devised what we might call in Western worlds a business plan. What she was going to do, how she was going to do it, oh yes, and how it's to be funded. She devised that business plan in a rather extensive manner. And she did it on a yellow legal pad. No word processing, no fancy paper, a legal pad on which she devised the plan to organize and ultimately take to the world the missionary charities and their work. As life became more and more complex, as more and more people came, she decided she needed yet another building. A man by the name of Dr. Islam, he was a local magistrate, a man of prominence, owned a large facility on Bow Street. And so she presented to him an offer to buy his building. He sold it to her at a cost well below its value. And it became the place where Mother Teresa established the first identifiable mother house of the missionary Sisters of Charity. And if you go to Calcutta today, it's still there. And by the way, it's not terribly impressive. It's just terribly effective. For she continued in the mother house her work with the hospice people, only now she expanded it. And she began to find old used typewriters. She began to discover old bits of tools and so forth. And what did she do? She actually began to find that people coming to the hospice to die could actually be helped and could live. And if they lived, they needed to have a way to make a living. And so she began to teach young girls how to type and become secretaries. She taught young men how to nail boards and how to plane boards, and they became carpenters. The concept that began as a hospice, caring for people as they died, took on the notion that every now and then there's a survivor. And when there is one, it's important to give them the gifts of making a living. By the way, at the mother house today, while it is that over 5,000 women are now associated with the missionary Sisters of Charity, that is still their headquarters. It's still the place where the orders originate. It's still the place where the function is served. Oh, and it's also the place where the dying come to die, where some learn to become secretaries, where others become carpenters, and where everybody finds some degree of dignity. Mother Teresa also opened a place called the Place of Peace. It was just outside of Calcutta, out of respect for the Hindu traditions. And it was there that she established a hospice for the dying who were not going to get better, the sickest of the sick. And it became a place, a haven, where they could live in comfort and in peace. And are you ready for this? Whenever a person came to the Place of Peace, they were immediately identified as either being Muslim, Hindu, or Catholic. If they were Muslim, they were read the Quran. If they were Hindus, she saw to it that they had water from the river Ganges, which is a sacred river. And if they were Catholic, she saw to it that the ministry of the sick, often called divine unction, was offered to them. Alongside of caring for their physical needs, there was this assurance of hope. As she dealt with the reality of people dying in the streets naked, another challenge presented itself. It was called leprosy. And so Mother Teresa began to think about how was the best way to deal with this ravaging disease that got the most help to the most numbers of people. By that time, Mother Teresa was on the radar of the Vatican. They realized that they had a person of significance. And the Pope sent to Mother Teresa a Lincoln Town Car as a gift. A Lincoln Town Car as a gift. She immediately sold it. And with the proceeds from the Lincoln Town Car, she purchased a mobile van that could be housed and equipped to take the treatment necessary to those who were suffering from leprosy. To the Pope's credit, he found it amusing. He also found it instructive. And it initiated in the Vatican circles a desire to support this little nun with more and more support. Normally, in the Vatican protocol, it took about 10 years for a new order to get autonomy and to become international. The Vatican, after witnessing Mother Teresa's efforts and success, reduced that to 8 years. And the organization known as the Missionary Sisters of Charity became an international phenomenon. As she became an international figure, she began to journey to places like London. And she went to places like New York. And unashamedly, in those trips, she solicited money. And also on those trips, she discovered some things that were kind of curious. In New York, for example, she discovered that there was a strange disease that was ravaging the gay community. It was called AIDS. And not too many people knew what to do about that. And Mother Teresa's response to that was, you have to do something. And so it was Mother Teresa who opened the very first AIDS clinic in Greenwich Village in New York City. That was soon followed by many others. And it became a fixation and awareness of the then President Ronald Reagan. He invited her to the White House for dinner to discuss how they could indeed make more clinics available. Two wonderful stories out of that dinner. That night they served a wonderful piece of beef, a lovely vegetable, and a rather large, huge Idaho baking potato. After a while, Mother Teresa called the attention of the president to the potato. And she said, you know where I live and work. This could feed a family. And as they discussed how they would secure AIDS clinics across the country, this was her final comment to the president. I will handle the praying. You get the money. Also, we're on her visits to London, she coined a phrase that was to become somewhat synonymous with her. She called it spiritual poverty. She began to write about how it was that amidst affluence, amidst abundance, amidst having everything you wanted, you could still live with the same desperation that poverty brings. Mother Teresa became the target of a fellow whose name was Malcolm Muggeridge. You may have known about him. He was a great English scholar, a marvelous author, a TV personality. And finally, Muggeridge decided that this woman needed to be interviewed. And so on one of her visits to London, he invited her to come onto his show and talk with him about her work. As the editors sat in the control room watching this program unfold, they began to question whether or not it could possibly be aired. Was it sophisticated enough? Did it have enough in terms of material? Because Mother Teresa's answers were rather succinct and brief and oftentimes to the point. When they raised that issue with Malcolm Muggeridge, his response was prophetic. He said, it will absolutely air. What you don't understand is this woman, in her simplicity, spoke for and to. She spoke for and to the people. The program aired. It became a BBC classic. It led to a relationship between the two of them, a relationship that produced a wonderful book that is entitled Something Beautiful for God. And at the age of 78, after having been a lifelong cynic, Malcolm Muggeridge became a Catholic. And I might add, a very good one. Across the years, Mother Teresa was honored in many ways. You all know, of course, that she received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1973, and she decided she would go to Oslo to accept that Peace Prize. In the presentation to that audience that was terribly pro-abortion, Mother Teresa took a very strong international stand, saying that abortion needed to be addressed. It was not a popular speech, but it marked the beginning of something that we'll discuss just a bit later. And the other interesting thing about the Peace Prize is this: you all know it brings with it a rather handsome financial stipend. And the Vatican, of course, assumed that Mother Teresa would simply give the stipend over to them because that was the way it was done. She chose otherwise. And with the stipend that she received for her Nobel Peace Prize, she was able to erect a high-rise apartment for the poor in Calcutta, India. By the age of 80, Mother Teresa's weak chest was beginning to take its toll. She had several heart attacks. She had to have a pacemaker installed. Ultimately, she suffered a significant stroke. And she decided it was time for her to move on. And so she resigned as the Superior General of the Sisters of Charity, the Missionary Sisters of Charity. Unfortunately, her resignation only lasted for a year. And by popular demand, the novices, the sisters who were doing the work, wanted her back. And so she came back, and she was there for nearly 7 years, with increasingly very weak kind of strength and health. And finally, at the age of 87, she was able to resign and stay resigned. And here's the interesting thing. The woman that succeeded her, Sister Nirmala, was one of her very first students, a young Hindu woman who was so impressed with Mother that she too became a Catholic. On one of her visits to England, she met a woman whose name was Diana. She was a young princess, and they formed a friendship. Mother Teresa watched as that friendship deepened, and she began to see how it was that her friend was in serious trouble in her marriage. And so she wrote Diana a letter. And in the letter, she urged that the young woman pray and that she try to find to do the best thing possible. And she ended the letter by saying that no matter what it was that Diana would ultimately choose, Mother Teresa would still love her. As you know, in August, Princess Diana died in that horrible auto wreck. And on September the 5th, just a few weeks later, Mother Teresa died quietly at the Mother House, away from the confusion and the noise of London. But her final statement was that she was praying for the princess. Now, in the brief moments that we have before us, let me give you a couple things to think about as you go home. The picture that I've painted for Mother Teresa this morning, I hope, has been impressive. The woman accomplished an enormous amount of good, no question about that. Today, there are over 5,000 missionary sisters of charity all across the world, treating everything from poverty to disease to political crises. She began an order of brothers. And so there are young men who serve in that capacity. She's become a worldwide figure. And today, the Mother House in Calcutta continues to be a hub of activity. However, Mother Teresa is not without her critics. And I just want to give you a couple things to think about. What are some of these critics saying? Well, one is asking why it was that she never attacked the institutions that were responsible for poverty. I guess that means, why didn't she go to school and study economics and try to figure out what the problem was? Her choice was to simply care for the people who suffered beneath the weight of poverty. Here's another critic. Why didn't she teach more of the Hindus Catholic doctrine? I think the best answer to that is pretty simple. She was once asked about her status in the world. Where was she? Who was she? From where had she come? She said, by birth, I am Albanian. By citizenship, I am Indian, because she did become an Indian citizen. By faith, I am a Catholic. By a human being, I belong to the world. So for her, dogma, doctrine, did not matter. And she allowed for the witness of her ministries to be her spokesman. She was also criticized for her willingness to accept money from all sorts of interesting sources. Some of them were criminals, some of them were dictators, but she took their money and with it did beautiful things in a simple way for God. She took a very strong stance on abortion. And of course, in our culture today, we know that that continues to be a point of enormous conversation and contention, not easily addressed. She also had a very strong position on divorce. She understood it to be the very last consideration of a marriage. She was also a person who opposed any kind of artificial contraception. And generally, some people say that her position on women tended to be less than supportive, in that she oftentimes saw women in very traditional roles relevant to her tradition. There's also concern about her use of money, in that she always made sure that the order was well funded. And here's the most significant, I think, the most significant critique. Her biographer has finally revealed some of the letters that she shared with him in the last days of her life. And in those letters, she talks about how it was that for most of her life, the proximity to God that she had experienced on that train went away. She talks about how it was that she lived with a kind of spiritual dryness. That's her word, spiritual dryness, that she could best describe as living apart from God in a world that was apart from God. She also was a person who wrote about the fact that sometimes she was angry with Jesus, because she believed that in the vision on the train, Jesus has said, if you leave the convent and go to the poor, I'll go with you. And sometimes it was hard for her to find him. Let me end by offering a defense for Mother Teresa. I will not speak to the social issues because they are very complex and personal, but I will speak to the last issue, spiritual dryness. Let me illustrate that by saying, it must have been very hard to watch little kids die in the gutter and be left. It must have been hard to realize that the food was running out and there was none left. So I'm suggesting to you that perhaps spiritual dryness was not so much a condition of apostasy, that is to say, moving away from God, but it was living face to face, day after day, 24/7. With the pain of the world. She once said that her life should be remembered as a person who did simple things out of the inspiration of love. And I think there I'll stop. I apologize for my voice today, but it's spring. Questions, comments, either from in-house or people online. Is there anyone?
If anybody online wants to speak up, just unmute and ask away.
I just wanted to tell you this is probably the most powerful seminar I've attended, and I've been here a long time.
Thank you.
Did her sisters or brothers, what did they think of what she was doing?
Ah, good question. You've read the book, haven't you? Yeah. Excellent question. Oftentimes the sisters rebelled against her. In fact, there were people who left. But let me put that into a context. When a woman or ultimately a man became a member of that organization, the very first thing they were told was that no matter what they were charged to do, they should also always do it with a cheerfulness. That is to say, for her, the manner in which the food, the care, the health was offered mattered. I thought about that. Strangely enough, on Thursday, I had to go to a physician. And you know how that works. Check in, give him birth date, da-da-da-da-da. And then they go back and sit in the room and wait. And finally, this young woman came in, and she was taking down my information. And we got to the question about the pharmacy. Do you have a pharmacy? Yeah, I do. Where is it? Well, it's the CVS over on Cochrane Road in Mount Lebanon. What's the zip code? 15243. That's not right. I said, well, you know, I'm sorry, but you know, we just moved back here, and that's the best I can do for you. And I'm fumbling around trying to get out of it. She was so nasty. And then she ended up by saying to me, you need to find out what that zip code is. And the next time you come back here, you need to have a list of your medications. He'll be in a minute. Okay, whatever it takes. Fortunately, I only see that guy about once a year, so that's not going to be a problem. I figure out by that time I can figure it out. But as I dealt with that situation, I thought about why it was that Mother Teresa said to these novices, hey, you need to do this with a sense of cheerfulness. Let's also look at what she asked of these people. She asked them to live in the simplest way of what was possible. And here's what that meant. All of their earthly belongings could be carried in a bucket. And those earthly belongings involved one sari, and I don't mean to be offensive here, but this is how it's put forth, a very coarse undergarment that was very uncomfortable, a toothbrush, a symbolic crucifix that was able to be attached to the sari, and a bar of soap. And the simplicity of their life meant that when they awoke at 4:30 in the morning to be on the street by 7:30, if they wanted to wash themselves or their clothing, they had to get water in the bucket. And that's how they did their laundry as well as their body cleansing. Toothbrush, they didn't have toothpaste, they had ashes. And the ashes were the means by which the teeth were cleaned. When they came in to the convent for the very first time, as an act of commitment, they were required to shave their head. She asked a lot of these people. And therefore, I imagine from time to time, there were some who were disgruntled. Now, there are people who say she was too tough on them. I'm not going to comment on that because I wasn't there. I don't know. And I guess it's a subjective issue. The most important thing is, there are 5,000 of them who are still out there doing the work. So she had some issues from time to time with some of her colleagues.
What do you think the difference was between Mother Teresa and her namesake? I think it's Teresa of Avila.
Yeah, that's right. The significance was, I think, that number one, she obviously had someone who taught her about her namesake. And her namesake, therefore, was all about meditation, prayer, study, and then service, not one or the other. And I think that 18-year-old girl was mature enough because of everything she had been through and had been helped with, she realized that's what she wanted. And she realized the importance of a name. So I think she chose Teresa because Teresa was a Carmelite.
Given the number of people she touched, was she ever considered for sainthood?
Oh, she is.
Yes.
Yeah. And even that has been questioned. Maybe some of you know it better than I. I'm not real conversant with the Catholic process for becoming a saint. I guess because I'm not Catholic and I don't ever expect to be named as a saint. I got a lot of laundry to do before I get to that point. But there's a point where you are nominated in a sense, where you are raised up, then you are canonized. But then there has to be some sort of a miracle that occurs that validates your canonization. There are people out there who have critiqued the miracle that John Paul used. I say to that, don't you have anything better to do? You know, I don't know why someone would get so fixated on making sure that a little nun from Albania did not receive being a saint. But that is a problem out there. Yeah. But she is now known as Saint Teresa. And of course, John Paul, I didn't get into that because it's so extensive. Their relationship was beautiful. He loved her and she loved him. And they shared a commonality, even though, you know, he was Mr. Institution. She wasn't. And yet they found a way to be affectionate and warm and share in the ministry of Christ, which was pretty important. Anybody else? Well, thank you for having me today. It's been a real pleasure to be with you, and keep reading. Bye-bye.